Does your company need to hire?
Sales account manager, regional sales manager, accounting manager, senior payroll manager, regional manager, customer service rep, bilingual telephone banking rep, marketing coordinator, recruitment coordinator, office coordinator, finance and payroll administrator, property administrator, administrative clerk, administrative assistant, clerical assistant, executive assistant, account executive, mailroom clerk, data entry clerk, accounts payable clerk, human resources clerk, corporate law clerk, financial accountant, chief operating officer, event planner, receptionist, data entry specialist.
The Bag Group are leading Canadian-owned and operated staffing and resource experts, trusted by Canadians for more than 40 years, because it's never just about a job. It's always about the right fit. Head to BAGG.com and find the right fit today.
Take your protein pills and put your helmet on.
Well, Dr. Jane Hawking, of course, Stephen Hawking's wife for over 25 years, is a writer, a teacher, public speaker. And her memoir, Traveling to Infinity, which became an Oscar-winning movie in 2015 under the title The Theory of Everything, and was a number one bestseller in the UK, was followed in 2016 by the novel Silent Music, the first volume in the Immortal Souls series. Well, book number two, Cry to Dream Again, is one of the things we'll be chatting about today with Dr. Jane Hawking. Jane, what a pleasure to have you on our show. Thank you for your time. I can imagine, having that last name for so many years has brought a lot of, media irritation. Have the media been bothering you your entire life?
Well, Drew, it's wonderful to be talking to you on your show. I'm very glad that we've made contact. Media attention, there was a lot of media attention some time ago, and I have to say, I think Stephen rather enjoyed it, and this was when he was famous, becoming famous, with publication of A Brief History of Time, and we had the media crawling all over us, and the children didn't like it, and I didn't like it very much either. But we had to go along with it because we wanted Stephen to be happy. And the only way to do that was to allow them to bring their cameras in, their notepads, their recorders, goodness knows what, and take over our home and ply us with questions. I've had a fair dose of the media since then. But in fact, I get on fairly well with them now. It's probably a dangerous thing to say. But I'm glad to say of late, the media have respected, on the whole, have respected our desire for privacy.
Well, again, thank you for letting us have another peek into your life. But more importantly, let's talk about Shirley, who is a talented ballerina who dreams of becoming a principal dancer at the Sadler's Wells Ballet Company. Did I get that right?
Yes. Yes. Sadler's Wells was the sort of one of the first ballet companies to be formed in this country, and it was formed by a formidable lady called Ninette de Valois. And she set up the Sadler's Wells Ballet Company, which later on would become the Royal Ballet.
Well, one summer, on the way back from staying with her grandparents in France, she meets a handsome young man, Alan, for a fleeting moment, and her life changes forever. Now, this is starting to sound like something that Julia Roberts is going to star in. You know what I mean? It's got this... I don't know. I went right to Julia Roberts.
Well, I don't know. Is she a dancer? Can she dance on point?
She's probably too tall, I think.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Well, I haven't looked that far ahead, and I write for the pleasure of writing. I don't write with a view to... My novels appearing on the screen in the same way that my memoir appeared on the screen in a modified form, with quite a lot of artistic license being taken by the producers, I may say.
Sure. Well, you know, this material, this fiction material that comes out of you, I always wonder, you know, there's got to be something wrong with someone to be able to come up with that much fiction. You know, I
sorry, yes, probably there's an awful lot wrong with me.
Yeah. Would you say that you are a love junkie? Are you a romantic?
No, I just write what comes. And I've had the idea of writing about Ruth in silent music for quite a long time, but one way and another, there was never time to put pen to paper. My life was very complicated, and I was trying to help out my daughter with her autistic son. So silent music was under wraps for a very long time, and finally, a few years ago, I found I did have the time. I'd given up teaching by that stage, and I found I did have the time to metaphorically put pen to paper. I'm afraid I don't put pen to paper because it's all done on the computer. It's so much easier these days. And then while I was writing silent music, I thought, well, maybe there's another novel to come. But then, to my surprise, my agent had rather a shock in store for me, because he invited me to speak at a club of his in London as an after-dinner speaker, and he introduced me as Jane Hawking, the author of Travelling to Infinity, who's just putting the final touches to her first novel, Silent Music. And he said, and Silent Music is the first of a trilogy. And I nearly fell off my chair in shock, because I'd had one or two ideas, possibly about a sequel, but for that to become a trilogy was rather more than I was expecting.
Wow. He just threw you under the bus right then and there. So, but it turned out to be a good thing.
It was a rather nice bus. I was very pleased. I mean, for a publisher to say, well, yes, we'd like three, was quite something.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Well, okay, let's get back to this story here. So Shirley, you know, I guess she's obsessed with him, right? And obsessed with finding him. And
That's right.
And now she longs to fulfill her dreams in the ballet simply so that he might see her name in lights and know where to find her. And with
Exactly. Because the sort of spotty sixth form boyfriend, sixth form being the last year of school here, sixth form boys that she has associated with previously really don't compare with this wonderful young man that she's met.
Well, of course, now we have the outbreak of the Second World War, and those she loves are in danger, and Shirley's priority becomes to help in the war effort. But with Alan appearing once more in her life and the war threatening to part them for a second time, she knows that she cannot cope if she were to lose him again, and that is the read.
Yes, that is the read. But there is also a digression in that development, because everything is going so well for her, and she's just about to do her audition for the ballet when she goes to a family wedding. And at the family wedding, one of the daughters, one of her cousins, falls ill. And Shirley is sleeping on the same floor. And what happens is that Shirley herself falls ill about 10 days later. And the illness is, having already been to the audition, and it went very well, and being offered a place in the ballet when the illness breaks out, and it's what was called infantile paralysis in those days, but nowadays is called poliomyelitis, and this heralds for her the end of her career in the ballet. So she has this hurdle to surmount, and of course all her hopes of meeting her beloved Alan just disappear with the terrible diagnosis.
You know, to me there seems to be, I guess, almost a duality to your personality. You know, you're known for being a brilliant woman with of course
yes you are.
Not everyone in the world has a PhD, my dear.
I'll tell you why that happened. That happened because when I married Stephen and I came to Cambridge, I was just after finishing my undergraduate degree in London. And so I had to go off to London every week, come back to Cambridge, look after Stephen, look after the house. But then when that was all finished, off we went to America. And then we had our baby son, and he came to Seattle when he was 6 weeks old. We were going, Stephen was going to a conference, and he took Robert and me with him, or rather I took Robert and Stephen to Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
So then we came back to Cambridge, and I hadn't really settled in Cambridge until that time. And I found to my horror that if you were a wife and a mother in Cambridge, you were an absolute nobody. You had to be a member of some sort of academic society. So I thought, well, right, the only thing for me to do is actually to start a PhD. I was able to do that, and I started doing a London PhD because Cambridge PhD had to be completed in 3 years, and a London PhD had no time limit on it. And so I plodded away with that, and that won me a little bit of respect, at least in Cambridge society, although it was jolly difficult to do, because when I was working on the PhD, I thought I ought to be playing with the children. When I was playing with the children, I thought I ought to be working on the PhD. So it was just one of those things that happened, and it was some sort of occupation for me. I couldn't actually go out and do anything else because I had a disabled husband and two tiny children. So what was I going to do in Cambridge to, in a sense, fulfill myself a little bit? But I don't think I'm brilliant for having done that.
No. Well, let me tell you, from a guy who I dropped out of high school, so anybody with a PhD is brilliant. Okay.
Oh, go on.
Yes, and
I rather wish I had dropped out of high school. Life might have been rather simpler.
Do you look back and think, "Oh, I wish I had become an air hostess or a dancer or a florist"?
Sometimes, yes. Sometimes I do, but that's not the way my life developed. And I suppose actually, having a PhD did at least allow me, as I've said before, to hold my head high in Cambridge, and it allowed me to hold my head high with Stephen, because I don't think he would really have enjoyed having a florist for a wife, unfortunately.
Okay. I'm sorry, I was just imagining that scene playing out in the movie. Wow.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Mm.
Yeah.
All right, so, you know, throughout your life, you've been followed with the shadow of Hawking. So you have a Hawking shadow. What comes with that that you love, and what comes with that that you really don't?
What I liked about it was the sense of fulfillment, Stephen's fulfillment, that he had achieved. I had, I think, hopefully, helped him to achieve his dream of becoming a famous scientist. And I knew from the moment I met him that there was something very special about him, albeit that he was just about to be diagnosed with motor neuron disease. And so I decided I could devote myself to him. I wanted to devote myself to him and to his success. And I must say, one has to remember that the diagnosis was that he had 2 years to live. Well, it didn't turn out like that.
No.
But he did fulfill my faith in him, and that was a great achievement. Mm. And we did have three of the most wonderful, beautiful children you could possibly imagine. The other side of the coin was that we went to a lot of official functions. And often, and I suppose it's the way of society, I was just ignored.
Hmm.
Or I was pushed out of the way so that cameras could take photos of Stephen. And I didn't really enjoy that very much.
Wow. That is, I wonder what that does. I mean, we're not talking just a season. We're talking decades of being pushed of being pushed aside.
Yeah. So, well, I just felt I was the also-ran. And it was pretty damaging to my self-esteem.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel more at ease, Jane, speaking about your life with Stephen now that he's passed?
No, I speak about it in exactly the same way as I did when he was alive.
Okay.
I don't think I have anything very objectionable to say, but I think what I am saying is just being honest.
Yes. How terribly British of you.
I'm afraid so. Stiff upper lip and all that.
And all that, yes. Yeah, that's right. The day you got the news that Stephen had passed, how did that become a reality? How did you find out?
Well, telephone rang at 3:15 in the morning. And it was my youngest son to say, "Mum, Dad has just died." And it was a great shock. I mean, we all knew he was very ill. But we didn't want him to die. Mm-hmm. And I'd seen him that very afternoon because I'd been with him. Every day was as often as possible since Christmas. And it wasn't something that was supposed to happen. He'd acquired a sort of immortal aura about him.
Mm-hmm.
So it came as a tremendous shock to all of us.
Well, pardon me for not knowing this, but that's part of what an interview is all about, I guess. I mean, did you attend the service?
Oh, yes, of course.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes, the funeral was a few weeks later. He died on the 14th of March, and the funeral was on Saturday, the 21st, and it was a rather chilly day, and we went as a family. We've been very, very united as a family. We all went together, and the funeral was magnificent in the University Church of Great St. Mary, right in the centre of Cambridge. And the streets were lined about 5 deep. So that was quite overwhelming.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, we're chatting with Dr. Jane Hocking, of course, formerly married to Stephen Hocking, and the author of a new book, a new novel, Cry to Dream Again. And people can get their hands on this book right now?
I gather so. I haven't seen it myself. I think the problem has been that there's been so much happening in the family, because not only, of course, was there the funeral, but then we had to work towards the memorial service, which took place on the 15th of June in Westminster Abbey.
Mm.
And there Stephen's ashes were interred in the a tomb next to that of Isaac Newton.
Wow.
And it's been quite a difficult period for us lately. And so that rather delayed the publication, because I didn't have time to read the proofs. And so that's why the book, I think, came out on Monday, 25th, officially. But I haven't seen a copy of it yet.
Who would be someone you would be very nervous if your book landed in their hands? Would it be someone like, Jane Austen or Monet or Chopin?
Well, that's very nice of you to put me in that sort of company. I wouldn't say that I'd be necessarily nervous, but I would be honoured, but they're in the sense of my inspiration. You know, the top position in literature, I think, in English must go to Jane Austen, but there are other contenders, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Monet is my favourite painter. Well, he certainly is at the moment, because not long ago we went to France and we saw a lot of the places where he had painted along the Seine, in Rouen, and so on. And there's just been a magnificent Monet exhibition in London. And so to find myself in that company, and Chopin, I just adore. It moves, Chopin's music moves me as much as any composer.
Jane, what was the first book you remember moving you?
Moving me? Possibly. Oh my goodness, that goes back such a long way. Possibly one of Jane Austen. Possibly a Dickens novel, possibly Nicholas Nickleby. But perhaps actually even more than either of those, Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte.
Hmm. What impact did War and Peace have on you?
War and Peace had and still has a great impact on me, because I think Tolstoy is the greatest storyteller. And when I finished a book, I tend to go back to War and Peace because I love it so much. Not necessarily the war, but the peace. And I find a lot of inspiration in Tolstoy. Particularly because one of the reasons why I love Tolstoy so much is that he gives us glimpses of his own life. He goes back to his young years. He creates characters and situations from his youth. And I found in that the justification for introducing memories from my own childhood into my writing.
Hmm.
But then they're all mixed up with fiction, which I think is the right way to do it.
A friend of mine wrote a book called The Shack a number of years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if you've come across it or not, but it...
No. What's the name of your friend?
His name is William P. Young, Paul Young. It's not... he would even say that it's not, of course, a brilliantly written book, but it had a profound impact on many people spiritually, and because it really combined, I guess, fiction and theology in a way that exuded the grace of a God we hope is at the basis of love, if that makes any sense.
That's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I knew very little about you, Jane, and then somewhere along the line, I found out that you had a faith and Stephen was an atheist. First of all, let's stop with the rumors. Is that true?
I had a faith. My mother was a profoundly Christian, and she was a great influence on me. And I think because of her influence, I felt that the faith that I had would be able to carry me through whatever happened in my marriage, because I knew it wasn't going to be easy. But of course I was very, very young when I first met Stephen and we were married. And so it was with the optimism of youth that I married him. But I still kept my faith. And I think without it, I might well have given way, I don't know, when life was really, really hard going. Possibly when I was looking after Stephen completely on my own and had small children. Well, the small children kept me going because they were so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But there were times when life was so difficult I didn't know how I could possibly carry on except with my faith. With my faith that I knew I was doing something that was good and was true, and I had to be true to that and keep that as my goal. Now, Stephen's atheism is a bit of a conundrum, because he was actually baptized into the Methodist Church, if they do actually baptize people, and he came from an agnostic family. And he, I think, was an agnostic rather than an out-and-out atheist. And I tried to understand his situation, and it wasn't that difficult. Because if at the age of 21 you had been diagnosed with an incurable illness which was going to kill you in 2 years, you're hardly likely to believe in a loving God. And then, on the other hand, his investigations of the universe, which of course required such a superhuman intellectual effort, they honestly did not leave much room for a creator God. Possibly he was looking for a creator God. I don't know. But even so, there is something very extraordinary about the universe. I mean, for one thing, the scope of it, the scale of it, the fact that we are on a tiny planet in the outer reaches of the Milky Way galaxy. What is our place in that huge, huge mass of space and time? And how is it that we are here? How is it that we are thinking, intelligent beings, who can, just through mathematics, discover some of the secrets of the universe? I mean, that for me is quite mind-boggling. And I think it must have been mind-boggling for Stephen. So I don't think he really ever concluded that he was an out-and-out atheist. I think he was an agnostic. Hmm. And after all, where did mathematics come from? The universe is governed by mathematics. Well, the human race did not invent mathematics. Where did it come from? So perhaps his God was mathematics rather than the Christian God of love.
Yeah, I have struggled with belief for almost all of my life, and I used to be a pastor, and I've stepped down from that because I've always I've always said, you know, there's just seemed to be so many in quote spiritual leadership that just should not be in spiritual leadership, and I had a look in the mirror and realized I was one of those people, so I stopped. And along the way, over the last 10 years especially, I have stepped out of the world of certainty when it comes to faith. And so, you know, there's a gentleman named Tony Campolo who's a bit of an evangelist and a speaker, and he kind of got up my nose one day and said, right. well, what are you then? And I said, well, I'm a red letter agnostic theist. And
I think a lot of people are like that.
Well, I'm starting to find out that there are a lot of people like that. And yet, you know, the theist part, well, I look around at this planet and I see purpose and I see design and intention, and I have not seen near the amount of things that, you know, Stephen Hawking saw in his lifetime. And so you would wonder, I mean, having seen the scope of things in the universe that Stephen had seen, I would be absolutely amazed that he would come to a conclusion, and I think you've just said this, he would come to a conclusion that there is nothing more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is no other. It's just us, it's just material, it's just matter, it's just energy, and that's it. Anyway.
Well, I think actually there's another dimension to this, and you say that you didn't feel equipped to be a spiritual leader, but in fact, I think there is a great need for spirituality. And I think if we lose our spirituality, which we are in danger of doing, it seems to me that we, as a race, we are becoming more and more materialistic, and materialism seems to be much more important than what goes on actually inside us.
Hmm.
I think we are doomed. I think our spirituality is one of the most important aspects of our lives, because it keeps us together. It keeps us together in communities of faith, in communities of families. And it also makes us want to help other people, take care of other people. And I think all that is, and all those are aspects of spirituality.
Hmm.
And I think you also, one finds, I find spirituality in music, I find spirituality in art, and I think I even find spirituality in literature.
Let me ask you, and again, we're chatting with Jane Hocking. Jane, you know, raising children and taking care of Stephen Hawking, that would put, I think, the best of any human into a state of depression. I mean, that is just an enormous workload that you were never designed to carry all by yourself. So do you think that, you know, again, I'm assuming this because I've read this, so maybe it's not true, but I have read that depression reared its head in your life. Do you think that was situational, or do you think it was biochemical? Has it come back, and was it constantly chasing you?
No, it's not constantly chasing me, and it was certainly circumstantial, because I just had more on my plate than I could cope with. And my parents were wonderful. They were a great help. They helped as much as they possibly could. But I have to say, Stephen was very resistant to having any help in the home. And actually, he was justified, because when we did have help in the home, the carers, not all by any means, but quite a lot of the carers came in and turned us upside down. They forced us into a corner, that's to say the children and me into a corner, and they worshipped at Stephen's feet. And that was a very disturbing period of our lives. Lucy was doing exams, and she just liked to sit with the paper in front of her, newspaper in front of her at breakfast every morning. Stephen was in his room, nurses, carers were getting him dressed, but one of the carers would come in every day, whisk the paper out from under Lucy's nose, and set it up on a reading frame for Stephen, who wasn't going to appear for at least another quarter of an hour. That was the sort of really irritating interference that we had from carers in the home. So, as I say, perhaps Stephen was right to resist having them, but the time came and there was no option.
You know, last week on the show, I spoke with a gentleman who has set up an organization that is providing support and care for those who support and care. And as I was leaning into this conversation and reading up on things, I realized that I didn't care. And this is just a horrible admission here, but because I've not ever been in a position of caring for someone with a physical or a mental or, you know, whatever situation or needs that they have. I mean, you know, I've raised children, but I guess to really understand the burden of a caregiver, you have to actually have been in a position of caregiving?
Well, possibly. I hope you, once you'd read The Traveling to Infinity, you didn't feel that you didn't care.
Well, no, I found it fascinating from a spectator's point of view, but it didn't move me enough to want to get involved, to want to help out, to want to... I mean, what can the rest of
what
us
about,
do?
Well, there's a lot that if people can do. They can join societies which do help. I mean, we have various societies in this country. I've addressed some of them. I'm patron of one of them. And there is a lot of... voluntary help needed to keep these organizations going. And for instance, it's not just physical disability, but also people with mental problems to cope with.
Yes.
Autism, for instance. You know, parents of autistic children are absolutely exhausted. You could join a club, perhaps, which helps parents of autistic children take them out for an afternoon, not the parents, take the children out for an afternoon or something, just to give the parents
a bit of respite.
A little bit of respite. the same with any disability. I mean, any physical disability. Off, join a society, a club, which provides a sit-in carer, somebody who will go and make a meal for a family with a disabled member, somebody who will perhaps go and sit with that person while the rest of the family go out for a little bit of a break one afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Plenty of things that come to mind.
But don't you think
that... You have to want to do it.
Exactly. And that's where I want to go with this, because I know this is a passion of yours, Jane, and yet I know it's a monstrous uphill battle to get, you know, especially those of us in the West whose noses are buried so deep in our own mirrors that or our own backyards, that we just seem to be so narcissistic and self-involved that we're I don't know, are we afraid to reach out? Are we afraid to connect with someone who is different, or we're afraid to be leaned on because we're barely holding it together ourselves? Why don't we care?
I think actually it's because any sort of disability is off-putting. Off-putting for people when they first encounter it. And it's only when they actually get to know the people involved that they begin to take more of... That they find that they are more concerned about it. I must say, we had wonderful neighbours when Stephen and I were first married, and nothing was too much trouble for our dear neighbour, Selma Thatcher. And that was so wonderful, because that was just how life should be, that people look after each other and people care for each other. And this is all part of the spirituality that I was talking about earlier on. I think spirituality moves you to think outside yourself, think outside your own little box, and look at the wonders of the world we live in, and want to help other people to share in those wonders as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think actually, for instance, if I can just give you an example.
Please.
Last week at Westminster Abbey, groups of disabled people were invited to come and join in the service. And I met several of them afterwards, and it was quite heartbreaking to see some of the young people there trying to communicate, desperate to communicate, but they had nothing. One young man had the most beautiful eyes, and I talked to him, and I knew he was wanting to say something to me because he was gesticulating with his arms, but his carers were having a cup of tea or something. And so I just had to keep talking to him because I couldn't really understand what it was that he was wanting to say to me, but I wish I could have.
You know, that reminds me of the L'Arche communities around the world, started by Jean Vanier, a good Canadian man, and Henry Nouwen. It was sort of the spiritual director of that group, and they were friends. And they have these communities of... I don't know what the phrase is these days, Jane, but, you know, developmentally challenged people might be one of the terms. And then, quote unquote, normal people, and living together, but not the normal people helping the developmentally challenged. No, it's they're living together in a mutuality, like a supportive mutuality. And if there for people like me who struggle with the tangible reality of a creator.
Mm.
I think it's those communities and those moments that actually reveal the creator.
Yes, I can understand that. And they show you, they also show you spirituality. They show you that love and care are what the human race should really all be about, not materialism, not grasping for the best for yourself, but making sure that other people are included.
Mm-hmm. As we draw to an end this conversation, I have one request. I was wondering if you could voice over a children's novel of some sort, because I could read my grandkids anything, and it would go over fairly well, but to hear your voice would put... any soul at rest. You have the most mellifluous tones.
Do I really?
Oh, it is unbelievable.
That kind of you?
Unbelievable.
Well, I'm afraid to say there's a great deal of self-interest in this, because the novels that come to mind, children's stories that come to mind immediately, are those written by my daughter, Lucy.
Okay.
Lucy Hawking. And she collaborated with her dad, but she wrote the stories herself, and she investigated the science herself. And they are about a young boy's adventures when he goes out into the universe. He has a next-door neighbor who's a scientist, and the scientist has a very special computer called Cosmos. And George, the hero, gets to know Annie, the scientist's daughter, and they're really naughty. They go into his office, and they dress up in space suits, and they instruct the computer to draw them a portal into space. And the portal does this, and off they go into space. They jump into space and have magnificent adventures. So the first one is called George's Secret Key to the Universe. And then the second one is called George's Cosmic Treasure Hunt. And the third one is called George and the Big Bang. And so it goes on. And Lucy has just published the final and the sixth story, which is called George and the Ship of Time. And I haven't read it yet, but I know it's going to be very exciting.
And will she be asking her mother to narrate, to do the voiceover work?
I don't know. I don't think so. But the great thing about these is that the storyline is very compelling. But there are also little boxes with essays written by scientists explaining the science. Now, if you just want to read the story, you carry on, you ignore the boxes. But a lot of parents actually like to read about the science in the boxes as well. So it's quite a, I think it's quite a brilliant idea. And it's nicely, the books are nicely illustrated too. It's really for 8 to 14-year-olds, these books.
So an agent once said to you, you know, you would never be able to publish a novel unless you wrote a memoir first. Do you still believe that?
Yes, I'm afraid that's true, because the name goes with it, doesn't it? Afraid that's the harsh truth of the way we live now.
Yeah. Well, what a pleasure to chat with you. It really has been a pleasure.
Oh, and you, Drew.
Yes.
I've really enjoyed talking to you, too.
Thank you, Jane. Take care.
Thank you, Drew.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye.